broadcast through the Wolf Spirit Media Network. Please join us in the chat room at wolfspiritmedia.net. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond, beyond. Tune in with TalkStream Live, search for Ever Beyond. Also, you can call to listen on 712-432-9588. Selected archives are also available on my YouTube channel, Studio 9 Jam. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Oh, that was better. Switch on the mute button, or switch off the mute button. Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, and happy summertime for those who have shifted and those who have not shifted and everything's screwed up. Well, commiserations. It's the beginning of Nightmare Fortnight. Good thing I had more than an hour this afternoon to figure it all out. It is now 10 p.m. UK time and 3 p.m. PST. And this is Ever Beyond, and I am JP. This is Ever Beyond Radio, broadcasting through the Wolf Spirit Media Network, part of the Alternative Sunday Service. And here we are. Have I got any announcements? Well, oh, we've got some interesting shows coming up. Not my show, but other shows coming up. We may have a famous time traveler turn up. More time travel stuff in the next couple of weeks. That sounds good. Or that will sound good, or that sounded good from the future. Who knows? It's all about that. And tonight I have a guest. I've never spoken to her before. She's a first-time caller, so everybody be nice. Play nice in the chat room. Nah, I know you always will and you always do. This is one of the reasons that I love this place and I keep it going, because chat room is a place that anybody can come and just be who they are and be accepted and not torn to pieces by this by the ravages of this world. Okay, so having said all that, I'd like to welcome my guest. Good evening to Jean. How are you doing?
Hello. Oh. I'm very well, thank you, JP.
Oh,
how's yourself?
There you go. I'm okay. this is I can see your ceiling.
I know you can.
All right.
That's there we go. Particularly when you see me. But there you go.
There you go.
Here I am.
There you go. You can turn off your camera. You don't need to have your camera on. It'll be fine.
It'll slow things down, won't it?
Yeah. And that makes things yeah, there's better. So, you came into the chat room and said a few things, and then Vanessa said, "Oh, why didn't you get Jean on?" So there you go. Here I am. It's good idea. Good idea, Vanessa. So welcome. How are you doing? What brought you to Wolf Spirit?
I came because of Christopher Jacobs to begin with.
All right.
Started listening to The Viking, and then I started to listen to more. I trawled through some of the back shows, and was particularly, I suppose, hooked in by, your talking about the trauma of the loss of Lyra, although Lyra is now back. Mm. And PTSD and all the rest, because it's very, very relevant to the mess that we find ourselves in.
I think so.
I might throw in here so everybody knows that some years ago now, best part of 20 years ago now, I trained as a loss and bereavement counsellor. So PTSD is kind of my stock in trade, and this whole thing about denying and being frozen, unable to move forward because of grief and loss, you know, it all sort of makes sense to me. But there's also the the issue that, that when I had a reading with Chris Jacobs about a year ago, that he told me that I was a Lyran, and that I had come here straight from Lyra. I hadn't been anywhere else on the way. And that my sidekick, my guide, who's about 9 foot tall, and I understand now that he's Pleiadian, and I were tasked with closing the portal to stop the bad guys from getting to the Earth. And we failed to close the portal, and so they got in. And I followed the harvesters through the portal into the illusion, and that's how I got here.
Interesting choice of words. Into the illusion. Do you want to tell us more about that?
Yeah, because my understanding, and this is kind of a gut feeling really, is that the Earth that we live on is a construct that we are being held together by what is commonly known as sacred geometry, but is obviously requires a few laws of physics into the bargain, which was probably largely put together by those folk that are that people would call the Anunnaki. But that's still a work in progress. I've been digging around the records that were available to me because I'm not allowed into the Vatican Library or anywhere else. It's, you know, where I might find real answers. I've been digging around for a long time and just picking up clues that actually seem to make sense to me, because I really do feel that, there is an enormous truth that we do not know, which is that the old Earth, the Earth that was governed by the what we call now the planet Saturn, when it was a sun, was the world of magic, and that the people who lived on the Earth at that time had access to a lot more power, because the atmosphere in which everybody lived was actually very much more energetically charged. So it was easy to do the things that you know, some people still can do, like levitation or translocation or, just telepathy even, that everybody did that, and that was just commonplace back then. And everybody knew that the power that we have, is just the power. It's just available, and we're all connected by it, through it, and we're made of it.
So, God, you said so much there. And okay, so how,
I know.
So let's just kind of break that down a little bit, because you first of all said,
yeah, yes.
And now I've heard stories about the solar system used to be around Saturn.
Yes.
Saturn used to be a sun, and that's is now right. Not.
No, that's right. There weren't as many planets then.
Mm-hmm. What are we talking about? Like a million years ago?
The then sun, Saturn, was like a brown dwarf.
All right.
And a brown dwarf has an enormous envelope. You can't see a brown dwarf from space because it has this big glowing magnetosphere, and the often planets will be orbiting inside this magnetosphere, and inside there is no night and day, because the light coming off of Saturn was much more towards the infrared, wasn't like the light from Helios, the sun we have now. It was of a different wavelength and of a different quality. And so, Earth was actually a really wonderful place to be, because plants flourish in the infrared, and, the atmosphere, there was no night and day, as I say, so there was no time. The only problem was that kind of, setup, Saturn was inclined to throw off electrical discharge, which meant that people had to live in a non-metallic environment. So they made everything out of stone because stone doesn't conduct as well as metal.
Fascinating. So, and how, you know, as I said, how long ago are we talking?
That's,
I mean, obviously in our terms, because
in our terms,
you know, like in terms of our years or thousands,
millions. It could be as recently as 12,000 years ago, or it could be much longer ago than that. This original idea was drummed up by Velikovsky in the middle of last century. And his book Worlds in Collision is very famous and well known. I've only recently come across all of it.
Changed my life, that book did. I tell you, because I was brought up Jewish and, there's all these stories and there's this Bible thing. And suddenly when I read that, the whole of the Exodus story just dropped into place. Ah, that's what they're talking about. It was a real account of a real thing, told in the words of then, but experienced as what we'd call today a nuclear winter.
Yes.
So,
and this whole thing of the massive electrical discharges from the planet Mars and Venus, not only did it leave enormous scars on Mars, it built huge mountain ranges on the Earth.
Mm.
So, because material was pouring from the sky, and why not people at the same time? You know, in the Dr. Judy Wood version of 9/11, she finds it very hard to talk about what happened to the people inside the building. Because the direct energy weapon that they used actually transmutes. It's a bit like the philosopher's stone. It can change the constituents of the element. So, you know, and mix together things that cannot be mixed, like wood and stone can be fused and so on.
Like you get in a tornado.
Yeah, but it's a molecular tornado.
Mm.
It kind of rips things apart and puts them together in a new way.
And from other insiders I've heard that it takes it took the iron and the even numbered elements and teleported them somewhere.
Yes.
So yeah, it's very interesting.
Yes, it literally just unmade things.
Mm. So let's go back.
Let's go back to me being Lyran and what that has kind of recently meant, because.
Okay. You know, so first of all, obviously you'd heard of Lyra before I did those videos, right?
I wasn't terribly aware of it until Chris mentioned it to me a year or so back.
Right.
Yeah, about a year ago.
Okay, yeah, so let's go back.
Yeah.
Using the magic time machine.
Classical music, yeah.
So where do you find this data?
Well, some of it just comes to me. I write. And I don't always know what the story is going to be until I start writing it. It writes itself, really. Especially when it comes to details. I wanted to write about this old Earth, about the world of magic, starting really with some very basic principles, which was that there was no day and night, that there was this access, easy access, to what most people would call sort of paranormal experiences. And that kind of creates a world of its own. You have to follow the rules. So you start eliminating words. You can't use the word yesterday or tomorrow or, you know, a few minutes later. You can't say any of those things. You have to start thinking about what it would be like to live in a twilight world, because that's what the world was like. It was neither day nor night. It was in between all the time. To live in a world where you couldn't see very far because the atmosphere was very thick and very misty. To where you could, where the sun was very close, but not particularly bright. And where there were no stars, for example, you know, all these sorts of things started, you know, they create a place, they create an atmosphere. And then I just kind of let myself go into it. And that's kind of where everything came from. And from it, you know, I have some experience of healing, although I've not really done much in the way of energy healing on anybody else, but I've had it done on me. And my main character is a healer. And it's a matriarchal society, which doesn't mean that women are dominant, just means that it's a gentler, non-aggressive sort of place where people are nurtured.
So that's the basic scenario, and you just wrote out of there.
Yeah, basically. And I wanted to get across some principles of, well, just to make the world manifest to people, to make it obvious to people without writing down a load of boring facts. So then you have to create some things that happen. So my heroine, if you like, well, she's not really a heroine, but she's just the major character, or she's the major character at the moment, you know, is sitting quietly weaving, because that's what she does when she's not actually treating people. And she's suddenly is aware that somebody is injured because she feels their pain and she hears their thoughts, and she steps to where they are because she just closes her eyes and opens them. And she's next to her casualty. And it's very much about, as I say, sharing with the reader this whole, dream world, if you like. But I don't think it's a dream, because I think this is maybe not tomorrow. This is where we should be heading, to a place where, you know, when you come upon somebody who is injured, your concern is entirely for them and for the environment and how the environment has been harmed by what's happened. You know, she looks around at the people who are also standing there, the friends of the child who's been injured, and she can see that they are afraid. So she sends them some healing. She finds ways of managing the situation, and of course she's aware of the life in the rocks and the life in the plants. Everything has a consciousness. So, you know, she is, if you like, she's managing that trauma.
Okay, and presumably she's not alone in it.
No, she's, people live much longer then. Probably, you know, 500-700 years, maybe longer than that. So experience is lengthy, and there are not perhaps as many young people, but there are as many people because there are more people around. So she has her skills. She calls upon the skills of others around her to help her. She needs to move her casualty, but she's not physically, she hasn't got the skill herself to lift this casualty, and the casualty is under a rock, so she calls on, she calls for help, and help arrives because people hear her, because of the telepathy.
Okay, so it was like an accident. So tell us more about the casualty.
Tell you more about the casualty. Well, it's a young kind of, well, I imagine him as teenage, but of course he's not, because there are no years for him to be old, so he's just not old enough to have given himself a name yet. And that's another thing that I kind of made up, that children are not, they're just known as the child of their mother until they're old enough to choose their own name, which is all about autonomy and sovereignty and da-da-da-da. But so this young person, this boy, he was playing with his friends and he was showing off, trying to telepathically lift a rock, and he lost his concentration and the rock fell on him and broke his arm very badly. So when she gets there, he's unconscious and she has to find his consciousness. It's sitting on a rock, terrified with his consciousness. So she goes to find the consciousness and gives the consciousness a little job to do and gets it to sing a little song so it forgets about pain. And then she goes back to the body and she stops the bleeding. And then she returns to the consciousness and says, you know, I've quietened the body down now. The pain's subside. You can come back. So she brings the consciousness back into the body. And by this time, a giant and a whole arrangement of other people have just turned up because they also felt the disturbance, you know, of the pain of the boy. And, you know, amongst them, the giant can lift the rock. Because giants are skilled in stonework. Everybody knows that giants made most of the big monuments that nobody can explain. So the giant looks after that, and there are some very ancient creatures who are much more skilled than the, if you like. I mean, I don't even say whether she's human, because I think that that's probably too big an assumption to make. I don't know enough to know that she's human. I just know that she is a person, a personality, with some of the attributes that we have as humans now. It's kind of a proto-human, if you like. And, these very ancient creatures who are probably like, well, people would know them as Sasquatch, or Chris prefers to call them the Anakim. Very ancient, very powerful creatures who have the skills to lift the boy and take them back to it's called a well chamber. It's not a healing, you know, it's a place of healing that she has in the hillside, that is powered by water and crystal, which gives light in the room inside the chamber. You've gone very quiet, JP.
Sorry, I'm here.
Yeah, so I'm telling you the story here. It's all beautifully written, this, you know.
So have you made it into a book or an e-book or anything like that?
Well, it's not that long yet. I got to the point where they became aware that there was going to be a major problem, because this white star was approaching, because what actually appears to have happened is that what we have now is the current sun came close to Saturn, and when the edges of the electrical influence, if you like, of the two bodies touch, there's a discharge. And because they were of the same polarity, Saturn, being much weaker, was switched off. And then it was turned to the opposite charge. And this, I suspect, is what Chris Jacobs would say was how they turned it to the dark side, and it was then used by the soul harvesters to subjugate the people of Earth, and became Satan and all the rest of it. I mean, I don't know about all of that, but I just have this sort of overview of that part of it. I mean, it will become part of the story as time goes on, but I stopped at that point because I wasn't clear as to whether the new sun arrived by accident or whether it was brought deliberately.
Well, that's the thing. So, you know, our solar system is a bit of a mishmash of stuff with bits of broken. Is there anything about Maldek in your story?
There will be. There will be, because almost certainly happened at the time when the two systems tried to balance out. I mean, there was a long period where there were in fact two suns in the sky, and I mean the Aboriginal people of Australia do record this in the Dreamtime. They talk about the two suns, and the iconography of pharaonic Egypt, where you have like the horns of the bull and the sun in between, and the kind of crescent that moves around. This is where the new sun was shining on the dead Saturn, and actually was you know, it looks like a crescent moon, but actually it was a crescent Saturn. This is when before it really got completely chaotic, and then it really, you know, there were two spells where it was chaotic. One where they had the polar configuration, when I think the people on the world of magic created the original lay energy lines in the earth to try and steer the earth and keep it steady when it started to be chaotic, when Saturn lost its charge. And I think that they did that, and then I think that was, and that's underneath an awful lot of the pyramids. And then at a later stage, that energetic system was taken over, and the pyramids were built over the top, and the whole thing was ramped up. And this is why we've got all over the planet all these things where we're looking for winter solstice, summer solstice, and all the different places in the night sky. They would have been of no use in the world of magic, because you couldn't see the sky back then. You couldn't see the stars, so that they would never have been any use then. But once the glowing envelope of Saturn had gone, and the stars were visible, and there were people knowledgeable enough to know that you could actually use the weight, if you like, of the Earth to steer it and to point it in a particular way. And the calculations originally were done on the 360 days of the year thing, and of course that kind of went out of the window because it all went a bit tick-tong at some point. Again, I'm not quite sure when that was, but I guess I have to keep on digging, and that will come to me no doubt when I need it. I don't know. Don't know.
So
I do this thing, you know.
Yeah.
Just follow my nose, really.
Mm-hmm. And so when did you start doing this?
Last year.
So it's kind of recent and still
it's very much a work in progress.
Yeah,
it is very much a work in progress, and I don't know quite where the inspiration to do it came from, except maybe from the Lyrans themselves. And I just caught a little message just as I was switching everything off to speak to you, somebody saying that the message had come through on February 29th that Lyra was back online and had reappeared. And that's probably about when I started seeing faces, when I closed my eyes to go to sleep and so on. Because just before Viking's show on Thursday, Chris had, I don't know if you've heard it, whether you were there, I don't think you were. Chris had a Lyran come on, Faye Lau, and say that the Lyrans were now on Earth. Well, that afternoon before he spoke, I'd been talking to Jessica Morocco, and I wanted to ask her some stuff, basically, for writing the book. I wanted to know some more of what I might be able to remember. And as we were talking, she started saying they won't. I was telling her about the portal, that's right, and how I'd failed to close this portal. And she said they want to know where to put it. this portal's still open. And she went to the portal and found that it had been, unsurprisingly, misconnected to Egypt. So this was how everybody got in into Egypt. So she then did some work with Osiris, which disentangled it from Egypt. And she said, where do you want it to go? So I said, well, why are you asking me? And she said, well, apparently it's up to you. You're the one who's got to choose where this goes.
So, no pressure.
No, absolutely. I mean, you can't imagine how gobsmacked I was, JP, honestly. And so I won't disclose where it went, but it's in a good place. And then she said, and then they want to open some more. And these are the places they want to go to. And, you know, I'll say that there are a couple in America, and there's one in South Africa and another one in Australia. But that was for me to choose where they went. So that was very bizarre, but they are here because, as she said to me, they're very happy now. And there, among them, there are people that you know. I was just, you know, just filled up. My voice broke and I could just feel them. I could just feel, you know, this enormous wave of love came over me. You know, they were so pleased to be back. So I do think that, this thing about how Lyra was destroyed, I think there is an older connection to Lyra than just the one of them coming here after their own planet was destroyed. I don't know why I think that, but I do.
So,
does that resonate with you?
The idea that, you know, this was not, I think maybe back in those days this planet wasn't habitable, and it's been, you know, calmed down since then. But yeah, I hear loads of stories. I don't know what's true. Nobody knows what's really true, but there are lots of stories, and I kind of collect the stories, and feels good. That bit feels right. Not necessarily it feels good, you know, because these are some of the stories are horrendous. But I remember when I did the Lyran trauma story, and again that came up, and it was like, oh, I remember how that felt, and
yes,
the kind of story constructed itself out of these feelings, and so let's come back to Jean. Right. What I'd like to do is, if Lyra was a patient of yours with grief, how would you move through that story with them?
I think that's, it's to look for the regrets. It's to, generally speaking, if grief is a natural process. When something happens to us that causes us to feel lost, we have an inbuilt, pre-programmed process that works. And depending on how serious the loss is, can be how long it takes just to heal itself. But when something is preventing the healing to go naturally, that's when people get stuck. And I think the problem with the loss of Lyra for the Lyrans themselves was that it would have been hard, I believe, and I think I may even know now why, they would have felt that they had let themselves down because they failed to protect themselves well enough.
I think that's a really key point, is the idea that, oh, we could have done this right, or we could have done this better, or we could have saved more people, or we could have.
Yeah.
There's a lot of
why
that.
Didn't you see it coming? Why did we do that instead of this? Why? All of the what ifs, they're always the things that people hold on to in their grief, and that stops them from embracing the grief and just understanding that loss is a pain that passes. And the problem for a community like that is that unless you have strong people within the community who are able to carry the rest and to bear the truth of it, which is that maybe they did do something that contributed, because generally speaking, if you've got that sense that you did something, you probably did, even though it may be very trivial. Yes, that's that thing. In those circumstances, if you have somebody saying to you, "Oh, you did it wrong," or "Oh, you brought this on yourself," then it makes it almost impossible then to forgive yourself and love yourself and move forward.
And so there's, you see, my thing was, I my stories, I told it over and over again, but I had a bike crash, 86, 32 years ago now. I still haven't got better, there's still bits that are broken. And one of the things that, I experienced was this thing they call PTSD and, post-traumatic stress disorder. Obviously not like, I was pretty broken up, but I mean, I've heard worse since then, soldiers and, people coming back from wars, which are very, very traumatic.
Can I interrupt?
Please.
And just say that you can't compare one person's injury with another. You just can't do it. An injury is an injury, and it's every injury is as serious as every other injury. I really do not believe that, I've done it myself. I've said, other people are far worse off than I am. When it comes down to it, and in your own world, you have to embrace how serious it is for you.
Okay. Point taken. So I experienced this thing, and my skin came out all itchy, and I couldn't travel in a car, and just kept on slamming my foot down into the floor pan, pressing on the brakes before the person would brake, and it's kind of crazy. It's like being slightly mad, and it's not functional. Really. It's very. And so part of my feels, when I say, I connected with my spirit guides, and this is about in the late 80s at the beginning, and like much more after the 2000. But they were telling me that, I got that because this is part of my mission, is to help figure out PTSD. But more than that, it's to do with war, because war is the result of PTSD, or a symptom of PTSD. It goes on internally and it goes on externally.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes into the extreme rage that never gets addressed.
Yes.
And gets buried and then turns into all sorts of weirdness, passive aggression and all of those things. Yeah. Would you like to speak to some of that? And, again, definitely. If Lyra was a patient,
How would we move on? We would move on. I think the first thing that, funnily enough, I have worked with people with PTSD. I have had it myself. And I would say to anyone who has no idea what it is, PTSD makes you relive that moment over and over again. And it is as real as the moment it first happened. So I'll just say that on behalf of all those Lyrans who did see their planet explode. That sense of the worst has ever happened doesn't go away, and the echoes of it make you fear, even though it's something that's already gone and done and finished with, it makes you fear that it can happen again. And you start making deals with things. You start, you know, this thing in the panic attack of, if I count to 94, you know, it'll go away. Or if I hop on one leg, it always feels better. You know, these sorts of things that create things like OCD, for example. That's born out of a type of PTSD, in my opinion. And so for those people of Lyra, it is about allowing yourself to fall apart and be grief-stricken and not to put the brave face on it all of the time. I know everyone has to do it sometimes, and sometimes it really helps. But I've had my own trauma, and at that time in my life, I had to simply go to bed and cry until I was unconscious, basically, because that was the only, it was no good fighting with the grief because the grief was too big. And I think this is the thing for the people of Lyra, and I think also for the people of Earth, because I think Earth has been through this same experience. And I think that's why the Lyrans and the Earthlings, if you want to call them that, have got this affinity for one another, because that same thing happened, that, you know, everything seemed to be going along swimmingly, and then, you know, like your bike accident, you know, something you didn't expect happened so quickly that you couldn't avoid it. And it replays at slow motion, but really it didn't happen in slow motion. It happened really fast. Couldn't be avoided. And it's changed you, and you have to learn to be new. You have to learn to be something else and let go of who you were.
Well, that's the thing, you know, it's moving into a different you.
Yeah. You know, whether it be someone with a limp because they broke their leg, or, you know, deaf in one ear, which they weren't before, or blind, or, you know, terrible things, and, or the loss of somebody you loved so dearly, you can't even bear to think about the fact they're no longer with you, you know, all of these things. That they change you, and change is really what PTSD is about, isn't it? As you say, war is a symptom of it because it breeds violence. PTSD makes you feel violent inside. It's a violent thing you've suffered.
It's, I've likened it, to like a bell ringing.
Mm.
If, when you you hit a bell and it vibrates, and then you put your hand on it, yeah, and it damps the vibration.
Yeah.
It's like the bell doesn't stop ringing.
No.
And it's not a physical bell. It's a, you know, there's some more subtle layers of our makeup.
There's this thing inside the bell itself, which is continuing to remember the stroke, but there's also all the air around it, which is still moving as a result. You know, it's moving away from you.
Mm.
So the whole thing is, it's not just the effect on the object itself, on the bell. It's the effect on everybody else. And another thing that I recently picked up on, I don't know, I listened to so many different things, but the fact is that we are, in my opinion, inside this construct at the moment, and the universe in general, outside of this construct, is watching everything that happens here, because what we are doing is having an effect on them. If we are making a new timeline for ourselves, you know, people say to me, oh, how do you see the future? I try not to, except in the haziest of terms. Everything is lovely and rosy. I know it won't be, but you know, you've got to construct something good to walk into. And you've got to allow yourself to be new. And it does mean letting go of the fear. It does mean facing, you know, Chris told me, and I wasn't at all surprised when he told me that I was an alien abductee as a child. And I used to be terrified, well, for most of my life I couldn't go to sleep because I was terrified of going to sleep. Because the things were going to come in the door and get me. And, you know, my experiences after I'd had a reading with him, I remembered one or two of them. They were not pleasant, at all. And, so, you know, it's about looking the bogeyman in the face and saying, actually, I can't be scared of you anymore. I have done with it. I am done with being afraid. So for the Lyrans, don't be afraid it's going to happen again. You've got a nice new planet. Enjoy it. Make it better than the old one.
Shock.
Yeah.
Is another layer.
Yes.
And...
Well, that's the first bit of death, isn't it? When someone dies, you go, it's shock. Even if you know they're dying, it's still shock when they die. And that's the thing that splits the personality. You know, this whole thing about PTSD also has this tendency to create multiple personality in people. You know, there's very often just a bit of you that relives this experience over and over. I once treated somebody who was reliving the moment of somebody's death every day, and he had been reliving this moment for 22 years. Wow. He could not get this person out of his mind.
So this is the thing. See, to me, the shock is the hitting of the bell.
Yeah.
And it's that keeps reverberating. Mm. And I, you know, personally, I find, you know, one of the reasons that I live alone is I'm really easily shocked. By something that nobody would ever know was shocking. It could just be somebody talking too much or, you know, saying a wrong word or something like that.
Mm. Do you think it feels like having a few layers of skin missing?
I don't know.
Is that?
It's, or that there's a great big hole that people poke into. You know,
yeah.
That is that I'm vulnerable and exposed about it. And, you know, I find that, you know, it takes me maybe several hours, I remember it used to take me sometimes months to get over these things, and I would be in a semi-zombie-like state of not quite, you know, I'm functional, you know, I can do my work, I can, but emotionally, I can't respond or react. And, you know, even just talking about it is bringing up emotions. And this week has been particularly emotional. For me. So it was, not wanting to have a counseling session on the air, but there's a lot going on right now, isn't there?
Yes. There's an enormous amount going on energetically. And also, and that's something I didn't really recognize, you know, if, you know, so that you don't feel alone in all of this, I will share with the audience that the first time I was seriously suicidal, I mean, I really meant to kill myself, I was 9 years old. Because not only was I getting the alien abductions at night, but my daytime life wasn't too great either. And, so I suffered with depression pretty much solidly until I was about 45. And then I did get some help, and I've gradually got better since then. I mean, they do say that therapists, which is what I used to be in the end, that's my last of many jobs, are the craziest of all. You know, you've got to be crazy to do the job in the first place. But
well, it's why you start looking into it and then discover you can help yourself a little bit.
Well,
and then you think maybe I can help others.
Yeah.
It's kind of a natural process, isn't it?
That's right. And somebody had helped me, and so then I wanted to kind of learn more about it. I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, in my case, I was talking to my own therapist about my inner world, and she's saying to me, well, describe to me what it's like. I said, well, it's like being in quicksand, and there is nowhere, you know, there's nowhere to go to. There isn't even an edge to it. Everywhere is, there's nothing to clutch onto. There's that, you know, and that was, you know, there I was 40 odd years old, I'm saying this, you know, I've lived like that, brought up two children, feeling like that. And, so I know exactly what you mean about these dark places where, you know, and yet to the outside world, I was a, you know, reasonably, successful person, you know, was holding down 9-to-5 job and, all the rest of it, you know, I was doing reasonably well, but inside I was a mess. In fact, inside I was nothing, because as we progressed with looking into that, I said, I feel like that fairground ride, you know, the one where you stand round a big circle and they spin the thing and then the floor drops away. I said, I feel like I'm in that, and that's me, and I'm spinning around in this thing, and when I look down, you know, there's nothing beneath me. And she said, you know, she said, well, can you really look into it? And I was terrified, but I did. And there was nothing there, and that was actually a relief, because I thought that there were going to be the dominant people in my life were going to be looking back at me and saying, you know, ha ha, see, we've taken you over. So, you know, those dark things, those shocks and those traumas leave us with very distorted views of ourselves and of the world.
And prevent us from moving forwards.
Oh yeah.
In a confident way.
Yeah, absolutely. They prevent it. My lifetime experiences up until very recently, and I would say probably up until as much as a year ago when Chris finally, you know, energetically went inside and ripped out a whole load of stuff that wasn't mine, and gave me the space to, you know, kind of expand into myself, that I didn't love myself. I do now. Sometimes I just sit here quietly and think, oh, what nice thing can you do for yourself now, Jean? And not in an egotistical way, just in a, like you would to anybody that you care about. You know, you'd sort of think, I'll buy so-and-so a nice present because I really like them. And I feel like that about myself. And this is like, whoa, this is nice. I didn't even know you could do that. And I think, you know, if I want anything for this brave new world that, you know, quoting a bit of Shakespeare there, is that, you know, our children should know that from the beginning. They should know that they are delightful and a joy, and that, you know, the world is a place of wonders and not of dreadful, horrible things and, you know, things to be afraid of.
Because that's it, isn't it? It's the looking forward with, you know, I grew up in the 60s and
like a lot
of us in, you know, who are around now, and I remember when, what was it? I never thought the 1980s would ever come. I thought that just sometime during the 70s that we're all going to get blown up by the Russians.
Well, there was that.
Then there was the millennium bug.
I can clearly remember walking home on the day of the Bay of Pigs, you know?
Hmm.
I'm a bit older than you because I was born in 49.
Yeah, Bay of Pigs. Don't remember that one.
No, exactly. But I can clearly remember that. And not knowing whether really we would all be there the following week. And also that sort of, around about that time, and maybe a little bit after that, I discovered George Orwell, and I read all of his books, just like right through the whole lot. And so when 1984 came round, I was kind of doing the comparison in my head. But actually, it should have been 2004, shouldn't it? You know, it would have probably been more apt. It's, you know, we've seen a lot, you and I, if you think back to that and where we've come from. And I feel now like I'm living in two worlds. There's what I think of as the real world, which we're talking about. And then there's this one that's on the television and in the newspapers, and which I don't think is very real at all. And I know everyone would say the opposite.
We call that the Matrix and the fake news and all of that.
Illusion.
But and like I said, you know, that was what dominated. You know, I seem to remember that when, you know, all we had was the telly. All we had was two channels, one channel, you know. And that's all we got about what the outside world was going to be like. And it was a terrible, scary place. And they still portray it like that, but I've moved away from it. Well, a lot of people have, because the internet has said, well, hang on a second, there are other alternatives.
That's right. Yeah, and until they try and take those away from us. But I mean, one of the things that, you know, kind of swinging the topic a little bit more back to the Lyrans again, one of the things that I'm hoping that these guys, I know they're not the only race that has reappeared here on the earth, and there are others who were stopped from coming down here who could have helped us in the past. Because what suddenly dawned on me the other day when I was reading something about the reincarnation net, because there's like this big net around the earth which traps the souls and makes them keep going back, that not only was it keeping us in, it was keeping the others out. But so we, you know, that we could get angry about them not helping us, but my guess is that they probably couldn't have. But my hope here is that, knowing as I do to some extent where the Lyrans are at the moment, that they will be able to finally take down some of this microwave fog that we're living in, you know, this dreadful, you know, background whatever that makes my ears buzz and, you know, stops us all from thinking a bit more clearly, because that's another thing, you know, we need to be honest about the fact that they are doing that to us. They're trying to dumb us down.
That we live in the world of they live. They live amongst us is the full title. So we're at the top of the hour, Jean, already, and I've found an appropriate song. It's by Etta James. A Change Is Gonna Do Me Good.
Good singer.
And welcome back to Ever Beyond. It's an hour early in the UK for those regulars. So welcome to everybody who thought that Ever Beyond would start now, but it's already been going an hour. We have been talking about grief, about shock, about PTSD and its origin. One of the ideas of, like, where did PTSD come from? Brought me back to a journey that I took back to Lyra, or it felt like Lyra. It felt like this is what I'd be if I was there. One of the things we haven't covered yet is the rage, the recrimination, the "I will kill you all." That I never expect. Actually, it kind of happened in two stages, because I never expected of myself to have that kind of, you know, genocidal feeling about anything. But I discovered somebody was reading a book, and they were talking about will, about broken, unbroken will. I think it was a John Storm book or something like that. Anyway, And I thought to myself, oh, I'm broken will. That's something that I don't have. It feels like something has broken it. Where did that come from? Went back. Where did that come from? Right. Yeah. When I was tiny, when I was a baby, being brought up Jewish, that's it. they snipped a bit off. And at that point I thought, and I remember, I took myself back to that place, and I remember the feeling. I didn't have the words, but it was the feeling of, I will kill you all, to every single man in that room, and my mother for letting me go, and happy Mother's Day. But it took, and some months or years after that, that feeling came up again when I went back to the feeling of that grief, and that grief took me into these layers layers of, there's loss, but there's yes, we could have done something about this. Yes, we got, there was something that terrible loss that happened, and layers of, yes, we could have done something about it, and self, recrimination, and all of those things, and kind of finally getting down to this, or maybe this is what brought it up, or that came as like the top level of, I will kill you all. And then thought, if that was the feeling of someone, what would you do about that? Well, you'd breed a whole bunch of people who could deal with reptilians and actually do that, actually genocidally, destroy a whole load of reptilians. And I believe that, this was the impetus for creating, what we know now as the Pleiadians.
Just for a minute, this is not so much for you because you've already done this, but for the listeners, just for a minute, allow yourself to think about the situation where you are the helpless, powerless, in your case, child. In my case, I wasn't, I was older than you, but, not that much older, who was not protected, or in fact was maybe even, not in my case, but in your case, that was being done to you deliberately, by people who should have been your protectors and your carers. Just for a moment to think about, the rage and the shock of that, and where you put what that means, where within yourself, where does that go? That is why it splits. This is why it splits people into, this someone whom you could be sitting in your office in the chair next to someone working away quietly, and suddenly they turn into this monster because something has triggered that deep wound. And that's what you're talking about. You're talking about a massive wound, not just the literal physical wound, the emotional, energetic wound. And this is what, at this point in time, as we go through these changes, we have to heal those wounds. Otherwise, we will just repeat it all again. We will be in the, drive to get revenge or to over defend, because fear is, fear is the thing that makes you over defend, that whole thing of, my heart's been broken, I'm never going to love anybody again, and of course it's a sterile world that you condemn yourself to as a result.
Absolutely. It's overcompensation is incredibly debilitating. For everybody.
My experience of everyone I've ever spoken to has panic attacks. When they're at the height of the panic attack, and I ask them to think about, You know, what's their greatest fear? You know, I'm going to die, I'm going to die, I'm going to die. And you know, what's behind that? You know, is there anything? They always come up with something that's already happened to them.
And that they don't want to happen again.
Yes. So, you know, as clever and inventive as the human brain can be, you know, really, it's working always on the, well, in my opinion, on the Akashic record, but, you know, this whole idea of resonance, you know, we don't hold our memories, not our long-term memories, don't hold them in our heads. We carry them around with us like a cloud, like Pigpen in the Charlie Brown, you know, cartoon.
Uh-huh. A field.
We've got this little cloud going around us all the time, which holds everything about us. You know, they were talking earlier on about DNA and everything, and I was sitting quietly sort of thinking to myself, I don't know half of the story, because DNA is triggered by your resonance with the field around you that remembers what it is to be you. And this is the thing you bring into your body when you bring your soul in, or your spirit, or whatever you want to call it, this electrical thing that makes you, you know, makes you actually be somebody instead of just being this mechanical, this, you know, bunch of bones and you know, blood vessels and so on. We bring in this electrical charge which brings our morphic resonance with whatever we've been in the past and whatever we're going to be in the future, because it all is a continuum. You're just on this, you're just somewhere on this kind of, you know, do you remember those things you used to have in the bar in the pub when you played bar billiards, you know, you'd push it along to mark your score. You know, that's, if you can imagine, that's what our lives are like. You know, they're on this big, you're on this big long slot, and you can move that slider up and down wherever you like, really. You know, we're not aware of that at the moment, because we've been mashed up in this mill through this reincarnation cycle that's broken us up so many times. You know, I get quite cross sometimes when people say, oh, you know, with the human race, they're a bunch of rubbish, because, you know, they do want revenge. They are angry all the time. They're always moaning, this, that and the other. You know, most of that is because we don't have all of us together. We have, all our best bits have been knocked out of us and left behind by this dreadful situation that's been caused by, I don't know, Chris Jacobs calls it harvester spheres, whatever they are. But, you know, this whole thing of making us go over and over and over and over and over and over. And, you know, they say, oh, you come to Earth to learn a lesson. But if you come in with only half the story to start with, what's the point of learning the lesson? Because you're just going to have to come back and do it again. That doesn't make any sense at all. No, we come here to be punished by and to be used by somebody who wants, you know, the fear energy out of us. And that's what, when I first realized that, that was what made me really mad, you know, that I could have killed everybody then. And it made me very reckless, and I thought, I don't care then what happens. And I actually put myself in a trance, and I basically put myself out there on the astral plane or whatever it is, and said, okay, you buggers, come and get me, because I've had enough. You know, I am sick and tired of this nonsense. And that actually is when my guide popped up, because I got so angry that I was hearing stuff on Chris's show about all this, you know, this galactic council and them making decisions about what was going to happen to us. And I was just furious, you know, keeping my language clean here. I was saying, you know, what gives you the right to tell me, you give me a quarter of the story or less, and then you expect me to somehow or other, you know, pull myself out of this? What the, you know, this, the fact that it wasn't fair didn't even come into it. I was just boiling, absolutely boiling with anger. And I sat here one day and I was watching a video about Bosnian pyramid, and Valerie Uvarov was talking about the connections in the brain and how that was like the cosmic connections in the ether, in the universe and so on. And I was looking at this synapse, and it flashed, and I got this feeling in my head And then lo and behold, there's a 9-foot guy standing across the lounge from me, you know, like 6 feet from me. And I looked at him and I looked away, and, you know, and I said to him, I said, I don't care what they've sent you here for. I'm not changing my mind. I wasn't going to back down. I literally had enough. And, at my age, I was 68. I think, well, you know, what have I got to lose? Yeah, okay, I'd like to, you know, be here for another 20, 30 years because I'm too nosy to die. But the fact of the matter is that I just thought, to hell with it. Somebody's got to make a stand and tell them what's what. And and it turned out that this is Leroy, my guy, but I didn't know it at the time. I just thought he'd come to tell me to shut up and leave everybody alone. But I suppose I've gone right off topic here, but I kind of, you know, got carried away there. But that's the point about the rage. If you've got the rage, don't turn it in on yourself. And don't necessarily turn it on other people either. Turn it on what you want to change. Put it into energy to make it better. Don't put it into energy to just get your own back. That never does get anybody anywhere, really.
Well, we've been doing that for a billion years, and that's, you know, so.
And that's why we're here in the first place, mm-hmm. You know.
And, okay, so, there's the shock. There's the layers of, you know, recrimination. We could have done better. There's grief.
And the rage at the injustice of it.
Mm.
And I think that's the thing. And then the grief is kind of, you know, if you look at the grief cycle, which is this thing of the shock and the denial and then the anger and then the depression, you know, that's kind of how it's talked about. But any counsellor on loss and bereavement worth their salt would tell you that those things can happen pretty much at any order, although you tend to always get shocked first.
Mm.
But, you know, the other things can come at different stages. But the thing is not to get stuck. All of those things are valid. There's nothing wrong with the emotions and, you know, there's nothing wrong with the thoughts. But you've got to, you know, this is where we need to help each other, because when you're in it, it's so hard to see it. You know, you're so consumed. You're just totally consumed by, you know, that moment. And it can hold you for quite a long time if you don't know what's happening to you. And a lot of the time you don't, and you need, you know, sometimes do need somebody from the outside to come along. And I think, you know, at this point in time where people are suddenly, I think a lot of people are going to see through the subterfuges and the lies and the connivances and everything, and they are going to be shocked, and they're going to be stunned, and they're going to be numb for a while, and then they're going to be furious. And those of us who are a few steps in front, I think we are going to be called upon to, you know, to try and guide. So we've got to be really strong in ourselves. We've got to be, you know, so this is where, you know, I know you've tried to make, trying to make communities for people so that we can reach out to one another and we can, you know, we can make solid that sense that we are all connected. It's you know, it's ever so nice to do the hippie. I mean, I did the hippie thing, believe me. And, you know, the love and the flower power and all the rest of it. But quite honestly, there was nothing to it. We've got to do something much more solid this time around. We've got to really mean it, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, you know, in those days, you know, in the 60s, yeah. Yes. We weren't so aware of all the nefarious things that had been going on, and we were just like, I'm not talking really we, because I was still we, you know. I just saw the Beatles going, yeah, 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 and all that stuff. But, you know, as I've grown older and realized what it was about, I could see, you know, it was being manipulated, right from the get-go. It was almost as if they knew it was coming and they co-opted it before it happened. And so it couldn't really take the bite. It didn't get the purchase.
The MK Ultra were in there, you know.
They
took it on. And a lot of those really quite cool groups, you know, were sponsored by the CIA. I mean, let's not get into that because that we could spend hours just talking about that. But the fact of the matter is that the parents, our parents, my parents, my mum and dad, but my dad had just come out of the war. He wasn't a violent man, but they'd made him do terrible things. You know, he had PTSD, my dad. And as an older man, you know, when he got to his late 60s and 70s, he was a bundle of nerves. You know, fireworks night, it was hell for him because he'd been a sapper. He was in bomb disposal during the war. So anything that went bang, you know, was horrors for him.
And, you know, in that place, anything could happen at any moment.
Absolutely. And you were living with death on from moment to moment. You're away from everybody you cared about. I mean, my mum and dad were born in the middle of the First World War and were young people through the Second World War. So, you know, I can't, although that, you know, my childhood in lots of ways was less than desirable, you know, with hindsight, and now they're 6 feet under. Well, they're not actually. They're in a golf course in Scotland, but that's another story. You know, the fact of the matter is, I forgive them because I realise it was bloody tough. You know, because all of this was against them, and we can't. We've got to stop it. We've got to stop it being against, you know, the young folk. We've got to stop it being against us anymore. We've had enough.
So, the rage sends everybody everywhere. As we say, all over the bloody place. And it makes it very difficult to focus. You know, like you say, okay, put the rage onto the change. It's like, where do I start changing the things and what can change? And have to work out what's immutable and what is immutable. Put your hat on.
Yeah, get my therapy hat out again, put it on. There's only one thing in this life that you can change. Now come on, don't make me say it.
Yourself.
Yes! And that's it. It's everything. You are everything. You know, it's back to this illusion thing again. The world you make for yourself is your world. Don't let the bastards get you down. That's rule number one. I mean, we need to do a bit more than just that, I agree. But, you know, you've beaten them almost by the time you said that. Rule number two is look them in the eye and don't be scared. You know, they've taken virtually everything away from us now. There's not an awful lot more they can take from us. Let's be honest.
Not much left.
No. They've had all our money. They've stopped us, you know, being able to invent things or, you know, they've turned everything into crap, basically. So, you know, I wouldn't even want to be famous now because it's, you know what I mean? When I was younger, I used to think, oh, it'd be quite nice to be famous. But not now, because if you don't do what they tell you, they'll assassinate your personality. You know, that's the next thing, isn't it? Where, you know, one minute you're, a national treasure, and the next minute you're in jail.
Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, also what's been, all the things that we've been programmed to like and respect is just utterly disgusting.
He's complete to it. Yes, exactly. And, you know, I don't want to paint my dad as any kind of whited sepulchre because he was far from it. But, you know, I was very fortunate. I was given a couple of really good principles, which I like to think I'm probably pretty much, I mean, I wouldn't say altogether, but stuck by, and that is, you know, one of them I got from Bob Dylan, which is don't follow leaders, watch your parking meters, and that is my number one watchword. So remember that. But I'm sure you do. And the other one is, the end does not justify the means. The minute that you depart from something that makes your heart feel good in order to achieve something, you're lost. What do you reckon?
Yeah. It's, well, it's a dilemma, isn't it?
Well, that's it. Of course it is. And you may stand there, you know, havering for a long time. But the bottom line is, the minute you've muddied the water, you know, and this is where, of course, the dark forces that didn't intend to be the dark forces, because I don't think, you know, okay, there may be some really evil creatures out there. I don't know. I don't believe in evil, really. I believe in balance. I think that, you know, it's all gone a bit too far one way, but that's because I think that the Anunnaki bunch decided that they were going to come here into the earth that had pretty much appeared to have been wiped clean, because anyone who was anybody had gone underground, and, you know, a lot of other folk just got wiped out. They thought, oh, we'll come along and we'll set up our nice little, we'll invent a few gods here, and we'll, you know, put people in charge there, and we'll make a few rules so that everybody has to be nice to each other, and it'll all be lovely. But you see, it doesn't work like that. You can't do that. You cannot do that. You've got to start from the fact that people must be themselves. And this is why when you look at the wonderful organization and civilization and tremendous political system, really, it was in the Aboriginal lands, like the North American Indians, probably the South American Indians as well. I don't know too much about them, but certainly amongst the Aboriginals in Australia, you know, they all had wonderful organizations where they would have their little tribe, and they had people whom they respected because they were intelligent, or they were knowledgeable, or they were skillful. And those people changed all the time, but it was always on the, you know, it was on the say-so of the majority, that the community decided for themselves, among themselves. And there was no structure to it. The rules were pretty simple. Don't interrupt anybody else when they're speaking, you know. And then now and again, they would have, I think in Northern Europe, they were called moots. So which is why it's a moot point. And they would call a representative from a number of tribes to a local gathering, and they would sort of, and it was just, everybody just got on with minding their own business. They had their own little patch. It mostly didn't fight over it. Certainly not in Australia. They, if you wanted to fight with somebody, you had to go into neutral ground. So, you know, that we could live like that. We don't need people telling us what to do. People know naturally how to behave towards each other. Animals don't have anybody in charge, apart from just in the sort of, you know, somebody to say, well, you guys go around that side of the deer, and we'll go around that side so that we can ambush it in the middle. That's all they need the organization for. We don't need it for anything more than that, really. You know, we just help each other out. It works.
Yeah, it's that's what we call clan, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And when you get down to that sort of level, I mean, I just a couple of years ago came back from living in the depths of central France, where everybody's cleared off. And I mean, I was saying in the chat earlier, I lived in a little village where we had five houses, but only three inhabitants. And I lived in one house, and two other people lived in another house. The rest of the houses were empty. There was nobody there, because people had either got killed off in the wars, mostly that's what happened, or they'd moved away. So, and I lived in what's called a commune, because that's the political organization in France. So there were about 600 or 700 of us who would sort of vote together what we did about this and that, and it was great. You know,
that's the story of how you got into the village of five people, five houses.
Five houses and three. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Brilliant. It's fabulous.
And so it was a commune. How long did it last?
How long did it, when it was set up by Napoleon.
Napoleon? The Napoleon?
Napoleon set up the commune system in France, yeah.
All right. Well, tell us more about that. That's interesting. Everybody thinks that Napoleon was a not particularly savoury character.
No, well, that's a bit heavy. I guess he'd live in England. What do you expect? The whole point about the reason that the English and the French don't get on is the French Revolution. The royalty in England were terrified. They'd already been kicked out once by Cromwell. And when, quite soon after, really, the French Revolution occurred, they were absolutely mad keen, the royals, to make sure that everybody in Britain thought that the French were dreadful, and Napoleon in particular was really bad, because Napoleon did a lot of organisation, built a lot of roads, set up a school curriculum, which that also existed right up until the 60s. They were still running on the same curriculum at school that Napoleon had set up. Inheritance laws are still the Napoleonic ones. And basically every bit of France was divided up into little communes, which was a few villages with a central mayor. And he was able to make an awful lot of decisions locally. And then, they had a couple of ranks above that. So they had a couple of the National Assembly, which is like the Senate. And so people were, they didn't make the laws themselves necessarily. But I mean, when you get into the middle of France, where I was, nobody ever came near or by, really. So you could do what you liked. As long as you got on, knew the right people, nobody would dob you in it if you bent the rules a bit. It was just livable. It was just everybody mucked in. I mean, I was unfortunate enough to have quite a serious fire on my property one night. I called the fire brigade nearly 10:30 at night. And bearing in mind it's a farming community, so everyone's in bed at 9. I had 4 fire engines there by midnight, and people were coming out of all the villages around to come and see if we needed any help. They got up out of their beds to come and see if we needed help.
So that's coming, bringing us back to the story that we began with.
Yes.
People helping each other.
Absolutely. And not being told to do it. Just knowing that that's what you do, because when you help them, they will help you. It's the way we're actually made, which kind of brings me back to my thing about, I don't think the human race is full of bad people. I think the human race has been horribly twisted and put under enormous pressure. And I think the opposite. I think it's remarkable that when when things do go a bit awry, people will stop in the street and help strangers. They're not afraid, really. They're not really afraid to muck in and help you. Not in the part of the world where I live. I live on the edge of Glasgow, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, I live in the countryside here, in the back of Beyond. that's why it'll be on, and. We're our neighbours are, we're great. It's wonderful to have it. I had an accident a few months ago. I cut my hand on the power saw, and my neighbour just dropped everything and waited until I'd been literally stitched up at the A&E, and then he brought me back home. Nothing more said about it. Wonderful.
It's what you do.
Yeah, it's what you do.
Because, you're in a situation where you're not up against the contrived fears. One of the determining things in my life happened to me about 10 years ago, I was on holiday in South Africa, and I was sitting alone on the beach by the Indian Ocean, which was pretty nice, to be honest. And I sat there in the waves, and I guess I went into some sort of, you know, an trancey sort of thing. And I just realized that I needed to get the crap out of my life and get back to, that's when I decided to move to France and would still be there, but I had to come back, unfortunately. It's family reasons. But, so this really is about what do we do when we are so shocked? I think we do go mad for a while. I think we do run around like headless chickens. And I think we do a lot of silly stuff that we probably think, oh God, why on earth did I do that? But I also, at the same time, I think that if you're in a community where people, without prompting, will come up to you and say, are you okay? Or can we help? Maybe you don't run around quite so headless for quite so long. And I think that's, to my mind, what we need in, you know, we will be doing in these new energies. I really do think that those of us, as I said before, who are just a step or two in front of the others, we will just find that place because we know what they're going through. We remember what that felt like. It's not that long ago to us. And I was often criticized for saying, oh, you will see the best in people. Yes, I do. Because when you see the worst, that's how they behave. If you see the best in folk, most people rise to the occasion. And they want, you know, nobody wants to be horrible. Not on purpose.
Usually.
No, I know, and I can hear, you know, people say, no, it's okay, and so and so did such as, and, but are you telling me that deep down in the soul, in the, you know, they may have got in the habit of being like that, and that may be all they know how to do. But I think we'll be able to contain those few, because there'll be an awful lot of the others, there'll be an awful lot of the rest of us.
So, coming back, bringing it all back together again.
Yeah, because I go off into stupid places.
Well, you know, this is part of it. And like I said, you know, it's being able to remain focused, to finding the way out, because we can easily go. I always liken it to, a roundabout, I don't know what Americans call a roundabout. You tend not to have them in America. They have them in Europe.
Something Wade Cummins had one. Brilliant short story by Ray Bradbury. What do they call them? Oh, I remember the Calliope. What the hell is the name?
It's a circular interchange. It's like, yes, rather than having traffic lights, you have a little circular island in the middle of the road, and everybody drives around it. But it's possible to just get stuck on it and just keep driving round and round and round and round. One of the things that, you know, when I used to suffer from things like that, it was the way to exit that is to actually dump down the thoughts, write them down, put them on paper, or, you know, now on the screen, so that it gives space. It's like you can't carry everything, and there are many things to balance out. You know, I personally can't, you know, remember more than like five or six things at once. So I have to write things. I don't know how many, but I think there's another PTSD thing. But being able to hold all of the variables in your mind is sometimes very difficult when there's emotions going on. And that's why it's always been good for me to write things down. So that's the place to start. Do you encourage, you know, going back to your imaginary patient on the couch? the story, writing the story, is that an important part of it?
Well, yes, because the interesting thing when you watch somebody talking, I suppose, necessarily without a focus, but just allowing the thoughts to pour out, is they often hear themselves saying things they didn't know they thought. Does that make sense what I've said? In other words, when
you find new things underneath the things that haven't been,
And a great deal of what really hurts us and traumatizes us is, what some people call the limiting beliefs. And sometimes they're very deep and they're very powerful, and they can be things like, if you think back to what your parents said to you as a small child, you know, don't be noisy, don't make a mess, don't be a nuisance, don't cry, don't, and in some cases it goes even further, don't be you. Be your brother, or be your uncle, or be, you know, don't be yourself. And when you get these sorts of monologues going on inside, and you're not aware of them, you can't counter them, you can't argue with them, because you don't know you're even listening to all this stuff, you don't know it's in there. And so that's kind of, you know, part of the splitting off that trauma does. Trauma splits off horrible things and buries them really deep, and you don't know they're there. You get the effects of them, you know, and they can come out in the rage, as you said, and they can come out in, you know, a lot of times, in my experience, they come out in what's known as the internal mafia. When you do dreadful things to yourself and you think to yourself, why the hell did I, you know, I had a great friend in that person. Why did I upset them? Or, you know, that was a really nice thing that I, why did I give it away? Or, you know, why did I do this to myself? Why? And that then really, how should I say, drives you down. That drives you into depression, which is, of course, another one of those symptoms that you get from your violence is one. And depression is the other with PTSD.
Which in a way is like internalized violence, isn't it?
Yes, it is an internal, and you turn it on yourself. So in this healing process that we need to be supporting, it is about finding the focus, and it is about finding the peace within. And it's very much, there's a woman in Australia, and I'm going to borrow her phrase because it is so good. It's called self-partnering, and it sounds terribly, you know, new age and all that. But actually, what it basically is being your own best friend. And back to that thing again, giving yourself the love that you deserve and you need. And here we are, you know, and what I need to say to Lyra, in the same way I need to say it to the earth, you know, what do you think the Earth felt like when it was, you know, bimbling along nicely with Saturn as the sun and everything was hunky-dory, and suddenly, bam, out of nowhere comes this damn great, you know, bright, powerful thing that knocks you for six, and people and things are dying all around you. You know, I had a little word with the Earth and with the sun, actually, a while ago when I was trying to straighten a few people out. And I said to the sun, you know, you need to forgive yourself for what you did, because you did a lot of damage. And, you know, we're just about to get, apparently, another burst of energy that's coming to us via the sun. And so we need the sun to be, you know, in a good frame of mind towards us and towards itself. So this healing is, you know, it's got to go everywhere and into everything, and you know, we've got to embrace the fact that everybody is hurt and that we all need to be cared for.
Exactly. And that, you know, home is where the charity begins at home. That's sort of,
absolutely.
Sort of thing.
And, I mean, you sounded a bit freaked out there. Sorry about that.
It's all right.
Well, I just take things to their logical conclusion, you know. If they tell me that planets and so on have consciousnesses, so why not?
Exactly. So we're working. We're coming to the. It's amazing. We've been talking for nearly 2 hours, and
I know. Gosh.
Yes.
I'm amazed. I'm still awake.
Well, it's a good, you know, for British people, actually, these 2 weeks are good for my show because it's an hour early. So right. You can still get to bed and hear the show. So there's, you know, there's the Lyran people on the couch. And in my humble, you know, we're all descended. We're all that same. We still hold that DNA, memory. Of that shock and trauma. And here we are. And it's like we're coming back. You know, one of the things is, you know, it's like, the story of the Garden of Eden and the biting of the apple and knowing the knowledge of good and evil, good and evil, knowing what's good and knowing what's evil means you have to know what evil is and what evil does and understanding from the inside. Therefore, we have not only bitten the apple, we've had apple pie, apple crumble, apple juice, you know, the whole apple gamut. We even buy Apple computers. You know, here we are at the other end of that big cycle.
Yes.
How do we tie it up, come home and recognize that we're all part of the same thing?
My feeling about this, and there's kind of where I came from with writing the book, is I just had this really powerful sense that we had to build a bridge. We had to build a bridge from before it happened to now. So it doesn't mean that what happened didn't happen, but what it means is that we must go back. Even though we have been changed by it, we must go back to what happened before and understand that it can be pleasant and it can be calm and it can be joyful and, you know, a good world, if you like. And that we can take from that, some of the things from that and bring them into now. I'm still kind of juggling my mind with quite how that's going to work out. And as I said earlier, you know, the old timelines, I'm told, have fallen away. You know, they made up this story, you know, to scare the living bejesus out of everybody. Excuse the bejesus bit, but because it's kind of a pun, you know, about that there would be a second coming and, you know, it would be, you know, the graves would open and the dead would rise and all this, that and the other. And I actually think that they, again, you know, they've been hoisted with their own petard. They made up the story, but the story's kind of turned around and bitten them on the bum because the second coming, in my opinion, and all these, you know, people who are coming to help us, you know, like the Lyrans, you know, this is what the second coming really is, which is our chance with our good buddies to kind of have a do-over.
Second comings.
Hmm.
Yes. Another way of looking at that maybe is that we realize that we are the ones that we've been waiting for. We are the saviors that we've been waiting on.
It's so fast and used to do it, is it? You know, my mum used to say that. Well, good asking you lot, I'll do it myself. You know, it's
if a job's worth doing.
Yeah. And that as well. But it's more about the fact that, you know, if we are really going to say that you know, we are the inheritors of this new earth, then it has to be ours and we must make it and not sit back for somebody else to do it for us. You know, that's very much the message that I've been getting from listening to channelings all over. You know, this idea that, you know, we're all God's children and God will look after us was made, that story was made up so that we didn't fight back. You know, because God moves in a mysterious way, yeah. And, I don't like his way of moving mysteriously or otherwise. I want us as humans to take our power to ourselves and to have the purity of what is, you know, the basic power, the real power behind it, which is merely a creative power. It's just, I mean, we're getting to the end now. Don't even get me started on
that. The power of our conscious creative thinkings.
Yeah, well, intent is what makes things happen. What we intend brings things into being. And there's a whole science that goes in, and I'm very much into that. You know, the whole thing about what the source of all the power is, what the source of the energy is very pure, and it is neutral. It is in balance. And when, you know, I practice a bit of Qigong, I'm no good at it, but, you know, I do bring myself to my center, and I try and get myself balanced, and I try to stay there. And I find that, you know, when I do that, as angry as I can become, I can expand my sense of self and my, what, for want of a better description, is the heart space. I can expand that around all that negative feeling, if you like, and transmute it. It's not that it goes away. It's not that I stop feeling the need to change things. It's purely that I don't put energy into it, because that's what they want. You know, they're living off that energy. I don't put energy into it. I put energy into me and into, you know, sending good vibes out, not getting caught up in their dramas, basically.
Drama.
Yeah.
Drama. Yes. And there, I tell you, there's so much drama going on right now. So we really need this ability to stop, take a breath, you know, get a clear thought going.
I couldn't recommend more to anybody. The whole thing about, balancing your energies and, you know, chi, whatever you want to call it. But chi is a good word because it's not tainted by a bunch of other stuff. It's just to recognize that you're an electrical being. You know, your chakras are not just pretty colors. They're, you know, between your feet and the top of your head, if you're any height at all, there's about 100 volts of potential. That's just purely, you know, the electromagnetic potential created by the earth and the sun together, you know, this envelope that we live in. We are very electrical. Without the electricity, we wouldn't be here. That's our power. That's the power that we can wield.
Gets very electrical after a while. And, you know, I had a conversation a few weeks ago, and it's like all about the words that we use for electrical situations is the same words we use for emotions and, mm-hmm. and also for, you know, when you talk about somebody who's very practical, they say, you say that they're grounded, you know, that people have a great potential and charge, and, you know, it just goes on.
Well, just very quickly, JP, I was really upset about something. You know, you were saying about it just wouldn't go away. I'd done everything I could think of. To try and remove this feeling of agitation from my body. Mm. And I just went out to the local park and I put my hands on the tree and it went. Just like as if I had touched a bare wire.
Mm.
Because the tree took that energy from me and took it to Earth, and it was gone.
Grounded out the charge. Discharged, yes.
Discharged it. And I don't know, maybe it's because I believe that it can happen. You know, belief is very powerful here. That's why children can do amazing things, because they don't know that they can't.
That's right. We haven't taught them that they can't do those things.
Well, exactly. We haven't knocked it out of them. But I guess we'd probably like to wind things up very soon then.
In a few minutes' time. Mm. It's been fascinating talking to you. Particularly about, you know, like, expanding the idea of, you know, grief counseling to a larger, patient, so to speak, or client, or whatever you might call it. And because, like, I'm convinced that, almost everybody on this planet is suffering from some form of PTSD.
They are, because if nothing else, they have been, their connection to their own humanity has been taken away from them. And that's PTSD enough for anybody, I would think.
Mm. And that we have enough, we have enough PTSD each to overturn and overtip each other.
You go back to this envelope thing, you know, I was talking about Pigpen and so on.
Yeah.
Every time you're in the environment, you're with somebody else who is agitated or fearful or upset, you take it on, you know, unless you're very disconnected, and then, you know, you're not contributing either. You know, you have those people who take energy and those who give, but also you can't help sharing with other people. And when there's a background, I mean, how many people just awfulize when you meet them? Oh, did you hear about so-and-so? And always, you know, oh, how terrible the weather's been, or did you hear about that shooting or this, you know, whatever. And we've got in the habit of just bringing ourselves down instead of bumping ourselves up.
Awfulize, I like that.
I don't claim responsibility for that. I'm okay, you're okay guy, I think.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah.
But, to indulge in going down the drama hole. And just making everything worse. It's like, they say you can...
Part of the tribe at the moment.
I'm sorry?
It makes you part of the tribe.
Yeah.
Because that's what the tribe has been expecting, that's been expecting from us. Mm. That's what we need to change about the tribe. We need to make the tribe expect us to be positive and not negative.
So, thank you for coming in at such short notice. Thank you for this conversation.
You're very welcome.
I think it's, you know, helped me tell a little bit more of my story and our story, not just his story, but our story. Beyond with myself and Jean Ollie. Thank you very much, Jean.
Mm-hmm. You're
welcome. No, not that one. That one. Up next is The World Healers with Frank Jordan.